Okay, I guess I'm going to talk about this topic. I guess one of the first sort of broken promises is that I'm not really going to talk about this topic. You got to watch out for that stuff with density functional theory. I have no background in atto science, and in fact, I've never really done a calculation in a strong field, or at least not with the purposes for the purposes being discussed here. So what I am going to talk about, though, is sort of density functional theory, ground state density functional theory, as well as time-dependent density functional theory. Most of my work has been in the ground state or developing time-dependent DFT in the linear response regime, so in a regime where there are weak fields in order to study optical response. But I am going to sort of give you some analysis and some thoughts about some of the problems faced with doing time-dependent DFT for strong fields. So I think at the moment I'm actually both at Rutgers and UC Irvine, as far as I can tell. I'm in the middle of moving, and my house has been packed today, as it happens, I hope successfully. Okay, so for background material, I'm in the middle of writing a DFT book, and you can get rough notes on that from the website. There's a time-dependent DFT book coming out with seven of us co-edited based on some summer schools that we organized a year or two ago. One of them was in Benasque in the Pyrenees. That's where this t-shirt comes from, with a little H-bar on the side. And there's another meeting coming up in this beautiful spot in about 3 weeks or so. Okay. So the theme is, what I'm going to talk, I'm going to give you some very broad background, right? I'm not going to present any real results of my own because I don't have any. But I'm going to talk about density functional theory, about the ground state theory, the difference when you get to the time-dependent case. So here I'm saying it's very, you know, it is the method that people now use for essentially all solid-state calculations and for large molecules. The time-dependent theory allows you, the original ground state DFT is just for static problems. The time-dependent theory includes a response to external time-dependent fields. So a basic question here is, so why aren't all the calculations that we're seeing here in the conference DFT calculations, since it's so good, right? And that's what I'm going to try to answer, why they're not. Okay, so I'm going to do very basic, simple things. This is my first transparency when I first started doing density functional theory. And I guess a lot of sort of systems and, that we've been seeing are in sort of they're either atoms or small molecules. What density functional theory really becomes important is for larger systems and especially for solids. And then the ground state problem, all you really care about when you do the electronic structure calculation essentially is the ground state energy. Ground state density functional theory is built around good approximations to the ground state energy. It tells you an enormous amount about all these systems. Because, you know, all the structure, all the vibrations, and all those things are given by the ground state of the electrons. Now, here are some points I want to emphasize. So density functional theory is an utterly alien way to treat interacting electrons. It is a sort of artificial construction. It turns out to be very, very useful, but it is artificial in the sense that the sort of methods used, you have to sort of rework quantum mechanics of interacting particles in order to do density functional theory. It's often misleading and sometimes downright nasty, right, in the sense that if you use your intuition on density functional things, you'll often come up with very wrong answers because the objects in density functional theory are not physical objects, they're artificial constructions of the density functional method. But if you can do it, it runs far faster and is far more accurate than Hartree-Fock, and this is why basically The world now uses density functional theory for most of its materials calculations. Here's an example from a friend of mine, Philip Fersche, at Karlsruhe in the chemistry department. And this is, a small protein, 645 atoms, and it was run in about a day on a single processor machine, including, optimizing the structure. So the point is that it goes fast, and that means you can do bigger things than you could normally do. Okay, so it's based on the Cohn-Sham equations, and these are the Schrodinger equation for fictitious independent electrons. It's simply a sort of artificial construct of electrons not interacting with each other, but in print they're defined to produce the exact density. And all modern DFT calculations are for these fictitious electrons, not for the real electrons of the system. And here they are. So it's simply you put orbitals in a single particle potential, and you define your system so that the sum of the densities of the orbitals is equal to the ground state density of the real system. And then you can show what Cohn and Sham showed was that the potential that must go in here is the external potential, the one-body potential that the electrons feel. So that's due to the nuclei and maybe some electric fields, a Hartree piece, and this exchange correlation potential, which is the functional derivative of the unknown exchange correlation energy. Now, I want to emphasize here, this is the helium atom in Cohn-Sham DFT. This potential, this solid line here is minus 2 over R in atomic units. So that's the nuclear attraction for the real electrons. But this potential here is the exact Cohn-Sham potential. So this is the, if I put two fictitious electrons into this potential, I get exactly that density. Now, if you ever want to sort of upset your quantum chemistry friend, you can ask them, well, does the Cohn-Sham potential, is it a correlated object or not? And if you think about this for a while, it will cause some concern, right? Because it's just a single particle potential. There's no correlation involved there. On the other hand, there's all the correlation of the ground state problem built into that potential, right? And you have to get used to looking at things two different ways. My point here is that there are exact quantities, right? This is a uniquely defined object for every electronic system, and all DFT calculations modern DFT calculations are in these Cohn-Sham potentials for fake electrons in fake systems. Okay. In reality, of course, here I calculated the exact Cohn-Sham potential for the helium atom, but in reality, you must approximate a small unknown piece of the energy functional, the exchange correlation energy, as a functional of the density. So you write a formula for this thing in terms of the density. And in the early 90s, approximations became accurate enough to be useful in chemistry. And in 1998, Walter Cohn, this is Cohn Hall, got the Nobel Prize in chemistry with John Popel. One thing I want to emphasize here is the time scale, right? At the time of the Cohn-Sham equations, I remember reading it very carefully and finding that paper very interesting, right? I think I was 3 at the time. And I was, in graduate school. I started working on DFT in the early 90s, right? It takes a while to develop the functional approximations and things, right? As I said, it's a kind of weird, artificial way of doing the interacting quantum mechanics. And basically, it takes years and years and years and decades sometimes to really make progress in density functional theory. So the functional soup that you'll have heard about, right? There are good sort of functionals. Now, this is really important. You choose one functional and you stick with it. I mean, the whole purpose of density functional theory is that you have, a single functional approximation. It's written down somewhere. It's put into your code. And you run that code, right, with that functional in there. And everybody uses the same one. And what happens is you get lots and lots of feedback on how well that functional performs. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't, right? But you get to know what its strengths and failures are, right? And you might have a hierarchy of good, you know, good and better and best kind of thing, a few different ones. But the whole point is that there's a single formula that everybody applies, right? And then you sort of discuss how well it does, right? So the original one was the local density approximation, 1965, and it was run for 20, 30 years in solid state physics. Not good enough for doing quantum chemistry, but everybody was running the same one. Then in the 90s came the generalized gradient approximations that made quantum chemistry reasonably accurate. PBE is one of them. This is now the most common one for solid state physics calculations. And then in chemistry, the common one is a hybrid functional with some exact exchange called B3-LIP. But the important thing is that you say which functional you're using and you get a result, right? And everybody doing all electronic structure calculations is using the same one. Then the method is non-empirical in the sense that the user does not get any choice, right? You run your electronic structure calculation with that formula, you get an answer. There is no empiricism. We're really big on no empiricism, right? Bad. This is what's kind of, you may have heard some sort of bad things about DFT, especially in chemistry, where you take several functionals and you run, maybe 16 or so, and you pick the best answer, right? The one that happens to land on the experimental number, right? That is not DFT as it's supposed to be, right? That's empiricism, so pure and simple. And this causes lots of problems. But over time, people sort of figure these things out and, things that are now, and of course, there's also, if you go all the way sometimes to engineering, right, you design your own with 2300 parameters, and that's just downright ugly, right? But this, since we're, mostly sort of physicists and things, this is where we want to be, right? Simple functionals, and then everybody uses the same one, and then it's not, so we're big on this sort of first principles thing, right? So, for example, in Thomas's talk, I guess it was yesterday more, he was talking about taking the ionization potential, and I asked him about the ionization potential for the C60 from experiment, right? Well, we don't allow that, right? That's a big no-no in our electronic structure community. But of course, so what's going on here between DFT and what you guys are doing is you're at this point where kind of, you're doing the first ever experiments, you're seeing the first ever phenomena of a certain type, and you want to do the theory, the sort of, almost in a sense, the minimal level of theory with whatever you have available to sort of understand the experiment, right? Ground state DFT is very different, developing DFT in the sense that we've got sort of thousands of people using it. The basic phenomena are completely well known, and what you're after very often is increased computational accuracy. You want to run the calculation and get a more accurate number. And this can be vital for, various chemical reactions, especially, say, transition state barriers and things like that. But that's sort of the name of the game, right? And you want it to be completely non-empirical, because you don't want the users in there, saying, oh, we're going to adjust this in order to get a good answer, right? But that's... So it's a very different field from strong fields at the moment. Okay. Time-dependent DFT. So over in the corner there, we have my old friend Hardy Gross. The pair of us were here at Santa Barbara 20 years ago. And he and Eric Runge put time-dependent DFT on a firm footing, proving that you could do the same sort of tricks for the time-dependent density. There's a unique potential that gives rise to a time-dependent density. And then you can define time-dependent Cohn-Sham equations. Okay. So, and TD-DFT is alive and well and doing very well, in fact, right? So I apologize to those who've seen, this is what I call the traditional exponential rise of DFT publications. And being a physicist, you can anticipate a real problem, because by 2300, the entire mass of the universe will be TD-DFT papers, right? So there are definite environmental implications. Okay. The place where it's having a big, big impact is sort of basically biological molecules, right? where you can sort of look at, you know, either the molecule itself or a small part of it, you know, 100, 200 atoms or so, and you can really look at what the sort of relevant HOMO and LUMO orbitals are and see what the excited state transitions are and really understand the optical absorption spectrum. And previously these things were all very empirical. They were, it's too hard to do full quantum chemistry calculations on these things, and so it's really having a big impact there. Lots of reviews. This is the one I would sort of focus on for the stuff I'm going to be talking about. It appeared in JCP last year. This is myself and Hardy Gross. And here's a mugshot of my group. And we're all in the process of moving to California. And actually, Peter Elliott is a guy who's working on a sort of strong field code for some of the things we want to do. Okay, another thing is that we're going to have a new Gordon conference in 2007, organized by myself and Carsten Ulrich, who's also here. So that's pretty good, right? Because, you know, actually there were kind of a few objections to setting up a new Gordon conference based on a methodology, right, rather than an actual sort of phenomenon and stuff. But because it covers such a wide range of disciplines and things, the people said, okay, go ahead. So we'll have that in Maine next summer. Okay, so now the details of how TDDFT works, right? So you have time-dependent cone-sham equations. Here they are looking just like the ground state ones, except now we've got time-dependent Schrodinger equation for our fictitious electrons, right? Density, the time-dependent density is defined this way. Now the exchange correlation potential is actually a much uglier animal, in a sense, in time-dependent DFT. It depends on the initial states of the system, because the time-dependent Schrodinger equation depends on the initial state. But you can always subsume that if you start from a ground state, because then using ground state DFT, these are just functionals of the density. But the thing is, you're going to need to know what the exchange correlation potential is as a functional of the density for, you know, everything that your system is doing for all times, right? And the density in your experiments and things is going absolutely nuts, right? This is the single particle density, right? Nothing else, and you have to figure out what this potential is. Okay. Now, applications of all of TDDFT, so it's all TDDFT in one slide. So the general problem, and this is the one that we're kind of talking about, is any, so I'm only doing electronic stuff, right? But in principle, any electronic system subjected to any time-dependent external potential. The one I'm going to talk about a bit in the middle here a lot is TDDFT and linear response to weak fields. And then you can also actually get ground state energies from time-dependent DFT. And the sort of basic approximation that's often used is that you use the uniform electron gas, the exchange correlation potential from that. Okay. So the big applications have been getting electronic excitations in the linear response regime. And the only thing you need to know is a new functional called the exchange correlation kernel relative to the ground state problem. You almost always ignore the frequency dependence, and you can use just a ground state approximation for that, and that's what people do. Let's not worry about the details of how that works. There's a code that people are using a lot now is the Octopus code. You can go on the web and find it. That propagates the time-dependent Cohn-Sham equations in real time. People doing linear response, especially in quantum chemistry, often convert it to an eigenvalue problem. But it's been very successful. The energetics, the transition frequencies in the linear response regime are usually good to about 0.2 EV. What's more important, really, is that the properties of the systems are comparable to ground state DFT. So this is very important in chemistry. Okay, here's a simple picture I wanted to show you and go through with you of a quantum defect in the beryllium atom. And to do this, I use the exact Cohn-Sham ground state potential, and I put my two, well, in this case, my four electrons in that, and then I apply TDDFT to that system. And the reason I do that is that I don't want any error coming from my ground state calculation. In real systems, of course, there's some error from that, but I want to eliminate that and just ask how well is TDDFT doing. So if I do that and I calculate the quantum defect, which is quite a hard thing to get right, you have to get your excitations very good. If I take this line here is just the quantum defect as a function of energy, the S quantum defect from that cone sham potential. And a key message here is that a lot of useful properties can be thought about in terms of these ground state cone sham potentials, response properties of the systems. So now if I turn on the Hartree, just Hartree interactions in this, there's a Hartree piece and an exchange correlation piece. That moves the singlets down to here, but has no effect on the triplets. And then when I turn on just the adiabatic LDA, the simplest possible density functional approximation you could make, you get these circles here. Which, I mean, to me, that's kind of real impressive and real evidence that TDDFT is really working very well in this case. You can see that, you know, it makes these shifts, you know, and it's amazing, right, because that's from a uniform electron gas. Okay, now, of course, I have other pictures of other quantum defects that look much worse, and I'm not going to show you them because I'm trying to, you know, say how good it is, right? Okay, Chris has seen some of these, right? Let's get to the meat, right? Strong fields, promises, and challenges. High harmonic. So the thing is, when you do DFT, right, and you, especially when you bring it to a new field, a new area, you've kind of got to just try it out and see what works and what doesn't, and then sort of figure out why, right? So generally speaking, high harmonic generation seems to work well. But you need orbital-dependent potentials. And now people in this community who have been doing some of these calculations have, you know, I think done a very good job in understanding some of these things and have figured them out. But then you have difficulty with things like multiple ionization, right? So let's go through that a little bit. There's a simple problem with ground state potentials, with the ground state potential. Your common density functionals, LDAs and GGAs and stuff like that, have bad potentials. And that's because it doesn't really matter so much for the ground state problem, but it matters a hell of a lot for what you guys are doing, right? Let me show you. Here's that helium atom. Here's the exact cone sham potential. And here's the local density approximation. And all of them will look about the same. And, you know, for example, this is the position of the HOMO in the LDA, and it's hopelessly off compared to the exact one. But if you do something like a self-interaction correction, which is a standard thing among DFT developers, not so standard among users, you get, for example, this potential here. And the self-interaction correction is an orbital-dependent correction that you do in order to make it exact for one electron and give it lots of nice properties. And here we see that it's, you know, it's very, very good. So you can easily cure the some of these difficulties with the ground state. And now the ionization potential in this potential will be good. And you need to do that in order to get your good high harmonic generation. And here's one of the first calculations by Carsten Ulrich, who is here, for high harmonic generation in helium. And here's a more recent one, well, a little bit more recent, showing the improvement in the numbers over the single active electron approximation for high harmonic generation in helium. And you know, the solid line here is the TDDFT calculation, doing a self-interaction correction treatment. So you have to do that, but then you get better agreement with experiment. So that kind of works quite well, and that's good, especially if, as we saw, Margaret Murnane was doing these, you know, very nice experiments for the molecules. But there are sort of key differences when you talk about something like multiple ionization, right? And the two of them that I want to talk about are the exchange correlation potential. When you're far from the ground state, it's not well approximated by standard functionals, and I'll give you a simple example of that. And the cone sham wave function can be very different from the true wave function. So these are two separate issues, okay? So remember I said they're fictitious electrons. Their wave function is not the real wave function. Okay. So this is something that we did a few years ago. In a completely different context, but you imagine having an exact time-dependent cone sham calculation in which you take a helium atom and you pump it into the 1s2p excited state. So just promoted to the first allowed one. But if you start it, you know, strictly a time-dependent DFT calculation will start with a doubly occupied 1s orbital, right? And if you get it to do this, and you can, and Hardy Gross and Jan Vershnik have done that, you find that this single doubly occupied orbital is now representing the excited state. But the excited state has, you know, has both 1s and 2p. Its density is non-spherical, and then you'll be taking the square root of that density to get that orbital. So if you go backwards and you go through the procedure to construct the exact Kohn-Sham potential for that case, it's highly non-spherical. So that's like really weird, right? But that is what exact time-dependent DFT does, right? It says that it must look like that. If it's stationary, if it becomes independent of time, that's what it must do. So this tells you that you're going to have a lot of difficulty representing that with adiabatic LDA or something like that. Okay, now one thing you can do, and people have done very recently, is do the exact calculation, you know, in a 1D model for the double ionization, and then invert the time-dependent Kohn-Sham equations to find the Kohn-Sham potential and see what it's doing and try to approximate it. And so this is just from last year, from Manfred Lean and Stefan Kummel. And what they find when they do this, this is a picture as a function of time of the solid line is the Hartree exchange correlation piece, and then the dashed line is just the correlation potential. And what they're seeing is a very large step in the potential. And this is a well-known effect in ground state DFT. When you remove a fraction of an electron from a system, the Kohn-Sham potential jumps discontinuously. It depends which way around you do it, but we normally think of it as taking an integer number of electrons and add an infinitesimal electron to the system. The Kohn-Sham potential jumps discontinuously. Again, it's an artificial thing due to the Kohn-Sham representation. But what they did very cleverly was they identified this this problem as being related to a jump in the potential, and then they constructed a simple model potential that had a jump in it, and were able to recover the double ionization knee that we heard about earlier. A double ionization knee for the helium case. Now you can go back in the literature, and many people have seen this in different calculations. So this is very good because they've sort of identified what was wrong with the Kohn-Sham potential, and this is a correlation effect. So even using an orbital-dependent functional, like exact exchange or whatever, you're not going to see it. It's got to be in the correlation piece. But it's well known that even that is not good enough, right? So even if you take an exact time-dependent Kohn-Sham calculation for the strong for this problem, you still have the remaining problem that the wave function is not the real wave function. And in principle, you know, the double ionization probability is a functional of the density, but we don't know what that functional is. And this is a calculation by Lapasse and Van Leeuwen, where they first, I think, showed that, you know, in fact, there's still quite a big difference between taking the exact Kohn-Sham potential and you know, making a simple model, taking the Kohn-Sham wave function as your wave function for the double ionization potential and the true one. So there are two different problems there that are mixed together. One is the, you know, coming up with an accurate Kohn-Sham potential for your system, right? The one that will cause the one electron density to be the correct time one electron density. The other problem is, even if you have that, and this is what's left here, that you don't necessarily know how to calculate the double ionization rate. Okay, so that's a real hard problem, and it's been around for, you know, quite a while. So I have some suggestions in the meantime, right? This is stuff that I was thinking about while I'm listening for the last couple of days, right? I think that time-dependent DFT can be used in other problems along the way while we're waiting to figure out a solution to that really hard problem. So Margaret showed these neat results, I talked to Zach Walters, who was working with Chris Green on doing the calculations, showing and calculating the transition, the strength of the transitions that they were seeing, the vibrations that they could see in the harmonic generation spectrum. What's interesting is the fact that in the last few years we've been developing TDDFT, linear response TDDFT, for scattering. And they're actually using, you know, an approximate scattering calculation to do that calculation. And this was, you know, a sort of prototype calculation, electron scattering from helium plus using time-dependent DFT. And you can see that we do better than static exchange for the phase shifts of electron helium plus scattering. Again, but this is using linear response, right? Not using strong fields. So it seems to me it's clear that there are places where you can use time-dependent DFT without necessarily focusing on the sort of strong field part, right? So here are some ideas. So build on the good results from linear response, like in scattering theory, and can they be used inside more demanding calculations, like the one that's being done, where you only use it for part of the calculation? Okay, another idea which I was pursuing with Jan Vershnik, who is a student of mine originally and then of Hardy's, we were looking at quantum control problems, and using the dipole matrix elements from linear response theory, which we know are very good in time-dependent DFT, but since all you ever look at is the electric field, if you can get the dipole matrix elements and then put them into a strong field calculation, then things should work. And one general, very general thought I've been thinking about is, it's kind of interesting that you almost always want the evolution in the same time-dependent field, right? An electric field. The reason DFT works at all is because all these electronic problems, you have the same interaction between the electrons. That's the whole basis of everything in DFT. So you have a similar sort of thing there. Is there a way to take advantage of that? You know, you don't need density functional theory for all possible external perturbations. You only need it for electric fields. So that's a thought for the future. So I'll finish. DFT is best when the physics is understood, but computational accuracy is crucial. Okay, that's what it gives you. So if you don't know what's going on, don't start running the DFT calculation necessary to find out. Do something simpler. Whenever it's used in the U field, you must take the present approximations and see what works and what doesn't. And that's where you are, right? The high harmonic generation is working. You find out that, you know, at the moment you can't get the multiple ionization. You've got to sort of figure out something clever about that. That's the big challenge. Now, for failures, you can usually rationalize why things fail. Very often you can see very obvious physical reasons for why a DFT calculation will fail, but it can take forever to figure out how to build the physics back into, how to build a functional which will recover the physics. And that's kind of, you know, a bit of what's going on with that time-dependent Cohn-Sham potential for the multiple ionization, the step. We're figuring out what the physics is that's missing, but we don't yet have a functional which incorporates that. But actually, what the message I'm getting from the conference here is that what may be the most important thing is, okay, so you guys have lived with your atoms and your small molecules, right? But you're about to, you know, people are talking about doing solids, doing C60, and I saw a picture of charge transfer in a biomolecule, right, from Ferenc's talk. Once you come to that point, you're stuck. You've got to use DFT because the calculations of the structure of these things and so forth are DFT calculations. Now, if we take Margaret's experiments, for example, right? You know, a student or whoever can run a Gaussian code and pick out the vibrations of the SF6, right? You don't have to understand how the DFT stuff worked. So if you just want to find where the vibrations are, that's fine. If you want the intensities, the changes in the harmonic generator, then you've got to do a more advanced theory. And, you know, and the interesting stuff is going to be when there are bigger molecules, right? And you want a theory that works no matter how big, and DFT is going to be it. So you're going to have to base things. But there's lots of in-between things as far as I can see. Now, the last thing is, the very last thing, you can do little tricks to make DFT do the right stuff. And we did one of these a few years ago to get double excitations. They're not in linear response single excitations. So what I want to show you now is, sometimes you've got to make your TD-DFT do some sort of somersaults, right? Because It's not a natural description for the phenomenon, but if you can build it in, then a zillion people can use that and it'll run fast, right? That's the thing. Now, sometimes you can't manage to do that. You can't figure out how to make density functional theory do somersaults. So instead, the next best thing, if I can get this to run, is to get a density functional theorist. So this is Hardy Gross. This is my dog. Now watch what happens. So you can't really get it to do somersaults, right? But if we watch carefully, you see you can get them to do cartwheels at least. Okay. At that point, I'll quit. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much. So I think there is room for a few questions.
As a theorist who's never used density functional theory, I'm somewhat confused by your initial admonition that you choose a single functional form and stick with it. And so what is there for someone who wants to do a calculation to do that's creative? I mean, what input do you have to...
The only reason I'm sort of saying that, and maybe it's not so much necessary for this community, right, is just the warning that you're not allowed to sort of fool around with different functionals until you get the sort of right answer and then choose a different one for the next problem. That's all. So, yes, I mean, you think intelligently, right, about which functionals would have the right physics that you need. But once you figure that out, once you've done a calculus and shown that that's true, then you don't start adjusting it, you know, when you go from helium to beryllium and beryllium to neon or whatever.
So it's still incumbent on the user to develop the appropriate function.
The user would normally take a functional that exists in the literature that has known properties and apply it. I'm saying it's dangerous to start messing with it. Believe me, right? It's a very subtle game. Yeah.
So one thing I'm not real clear about is when you have problems with complex molecules, we know when we're dealing with wave functions, how to calculate non-adiabatic coupling, how to do Landau-Zener theory, avoided crossings. You may have conical intersections with complex molecules. How well is that all been mapped out for density functional calculations? Have all these things, is there a treatment of all these phenomena already with TDDFT?
I would say no. So I didn't go into any of that, right? People have been using it for, you know, 5 or 6 years, and they're sort of finding in generic cases that it sort of usually works, and then there are a lot of cases where specific problems occur. So we saw, for example, the charge transfer picture. TDDFT in its current form has difficulties, the approximations have difficulties for charge transfer. I haven't studied this, but people have said that for the conical intersections, there's also problems. So it's not that far different, right? It's still in this area where people are running calculations and finding out, you know, by comparison with experiment, what works and what doesn't. So what I showed you was the generic kind of case where it's kind of working and it's very useful, but, you know, there are lots of specific things that don't fail, and we can sort of try to understand why they fail and then spend a long time trying to figure out how to fix them, right? So it's not, I would not say well mapped out at all. And what is often the case is, I mean, it does the calculation and then you sort of scratch your head as to figure out, well, why it failed, and then the worst thing is always trying to figure out a way to make it work without breaking all the other good things that it does.
Okay, I don't see further questions. Thank you very much again.
Welcome.
And we are